Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review dated Thursday, April 16th, 2026. We'll start with an article on the front page headlined, Community, Second Chances Rebuild Lives. Trauma-Informed and Rich Program Guides Path to Career Opportunities by Valerie Wells. Decatur. When Maria Pabon left Chicago for Decatur in 2019, fleeing an abusive relationship, she chose Decatur because her best friend had moved here. I just decided to run one day, Pabon said. It was Father's Day, and he was working. And I just decided that was the time to escape. Friends helped her pack her things into a U-Haul, and he came home from work to an empty house. She knew she had to leave town to be safe, she said. At first, she and her two children lived in a hotel, but now she is an owner-operator of her own semi-truck and is planning to add a hopper-bottom trailer. She is this year's Lamont Wright Truck Driver of the Year Award winner, and she took her training from the Enrich program at Richland Community College. Her best friend told her about it. Enrich was founded in 2017 by the Reverend Courtney Carson, Vice President of External Relations at Richland Community College, specifically to provide job training for people like Pabon and for anyone else who needs a helping hand to move into self-sufficiency from past trauma and barriers that have kept them from success. A key component of the training is provided by Enrich is trauma-informed practices, which Tamika Thomas, Director of the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act Department for Enrich, studied as part of her doctoral program to write a report entitled, The Effect of Trauma-Informed Practices on Commercial Driver's License Class Completion Rates. I started working for the Enrich program, and I noticed that it was very different from all of the other academic programs that I was in or had worked at or talked about, Thomas said. It seemed that they were having a lot of success. I thought, let's dig into why these students are faring better, or seem to be faring better, than other students that I've worked with. Enrich began as a construction skills training program, Carson said, but soon became a training program for CDLs, and now includes training in healthcare, paraprofessionals in education, certifications in hazmat, forklift, and occupational safety and health administration, as well as workforce development, the minority mentor-protege program, and the essential skills class, which includes deep discussion on how to maintain composure, behave professionally, and understand yourself and why you might react the way you do. And that, both Thomas and Carson said, is the reason the students do so well. A number of students in the Enrich program are ex-inmates or come from troubled backgrounds with abuse, alcoholism, or drug use in the home. Carson was a troubled teen himself, one of the Decatur Seven, who were expelled for a fight at a football game, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson took Carson under his wing and helped him turn his life around, teaching and modeling for him how to be successful. I wanted to do for the students in Enrich what Reverend Jackson did for me, Carson said. And one of the graduates of Enrich is Sean Honorable, another of the Decatur Seven, whom Carson was able to help and who is now gainfully employed and self-supporting. Myris Matthews, who served 15 years in prison, was so successful that he has become a mentor in the program. When he was incarcerated, he said, he used his time to further his education, reading and studying and earning enough college credits for an associate's degree, and earned an HVAC, heating, ventilation, air conditioning certification. The day after he was released, he went to Enrich to sign up for classes because people had told him about the program and about Carson. He refused to let his time in prison keep him from a successful life afterward. At that time, Enrich had an outreach program called Male Involvement, and I was the poster guy for that program because the time I spent in prison, when I came home, you couldn't even tell I was incarcerated, he said. I utilized my time. Mentally, I wasn't in prison. I read voraciously. It was shocking to a lot of people because you couldn't tell I was locked up from age 21 to 36. In November 2025, he received his bachelor's degree in business administration. I had dedication and determination, he said. I made a mistake, and I can never jeopardize my freedom like that again. He worked for G&D Trucking and for ADM before going out on his own, and now owns his own trucking company, with plans to buy box trucks and add a moving business to his already busy life, while still driving one of his own trucks. He's married with two children and grateful, he said, that he is able to mentor other men and help them be positive and productive. I'd like to give thanks for Enrich, Matthew said. It is designed to save lives, get people off the streets and off into their own workplaces and businesses and career opportunities. Everyone has had some kind of trauma in their life, Thomas said, and something like the COVID-19 pandemic, for example, can stick with you for years. Enrich helps people, like it helped Matthews, move into success. We like to say that some traumas are bigger than other traumas, but all traumas affect the way that we learn and the way that we think, Thomas said. We're dealing with a population of students where virtually everyone has been affected by some form of trauma, whether that's that pandemic trauma, previous incarceration, food insecurity, homelessness, or situations where they're in a home where a parent is abusive, alcohol abuse, drug addiction, all of those things. With so many students who were affected by those experiences in the Enrich program, she studied data that tracked how trauma-informed practices work to help them. When you're talking about trauma, everyone who is a human being has experienced adult and child experiences, and all of us have experienced some kind of trauma that has not been dealt with, Carson said. Maybe they're dealing with it currently, but not to the extent that they're over it. They're experiencing trauma every single day, and ultimately, what one has to go through is the minimum of 10 years to fully get over that trauma behavior that is in their body. You react physically to trauma, Carson said, and when he looked at workforce training, he thought he had to consider physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual aspects of helping people recover so that they could not just get a job, but to thrive in every way. I don't want anybody to drive a $200,000 piece of equipment without understanding themselves as a person and understanding what their limitations are as a human being, Carson said. I didn't know I was able to respond to certain people the way I should have until I was in a classroom with young people, and I learned I'm not anointed to do that. For the CDL program, I said, let's do trauma-informed practices on the front end, so individuals can deal with their adverse experiences, deal with those experiences, and learn how to regulate when their nervous system activates, and teach them how to deal with that. For Pabon, that essential skills class was vital. She credits Terrence Taylor, better known in Decatur as Tat, who teaches that class, with giving her the tools she needed to deal with her own history. I owe him so much, she said. Energy. Policy shift stirs Illinois coal debate. Powerton Station Union in Pekin backs EPA rule reversal by Gabriel Matias Castellanjo. Medill, Illinois News Bureau, Peoria. As Illinois officials remain strongly committed to closing coal-fired power plants, federal policies under the Trump administration are creating uncertainty, spurring legal action, and a push by some to keep the plants open. Earlier this year, President Donald Trump and Lee Zeldin, head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, announced the repeal of what is known as the endangerment finding, which provides the backbone for federal governmental regulations on greenhouse gas emissions. The move means the federal EPA will no longer regulate dangerous emissions from sources like cars, trucks, and power plants. Environmental organizations now fear these policy shifts could change the calculus for plant operators and potentially slow planned closings. According to the National Institutes of Health, coal-burning plants are a major source of air pollution, emitting toxins like sulfur dioxide, black carbon, and metals into the air. Kate Caldwell, Senior Policy Manager at the Illinois Environmental Council, said, while the state's Clean and Equitable Jobs Act puts the state on a strong path to limiting pollution, the act calls for closing the plants by 2030. It can't provide enough incentives for clean energy without support from federal action. She said the ruling could create temporary economic incentives for the continued operation of coal-powered plants. CEJA is a strong policy foundation for Illinois, but it works best when federal policy supports rather than diminishes state climate progress, Caldwell said. The big picture is this. Federal policy and state-level policy can enhance one another and deliver incredible progress when working in tandem. Illinois has joined a coalition of 24 states in suing the EPA over its decision to renounce its fight against climate change. Rescinding this EPA determination will undo progress we have made to address climate change by eliminating existing EPA greenhouse gas emissions standards for vehicles and undermining the EPA's mandate to regulate harmful air pollution that causes climate change, Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul said in a statement. Governor J.B. Pritzker also has spoken out forcefully in opposition to the repeal. While Trump sells out our nation's future, I won't stop believing in the science and fighting for what Illinoisans need, affordable energy, clean air and water, and good jobs, he said after the repeal was announced in February. Representative Charlie Meyer, Republican, Ocalville, said he supports the administration's decision to repeal the endangerment finding. It made it harder for states like Illinois to keep reliable power online, he said, adding that the state needs to stop doubling down on unrealistic mandates that drive up prices for folks against Illinois and weaken our energy grid. Illinois is facing serious energy grid challenges because of Springfield's push to shut down coal and natural gas plants irresponsibly, Meyer said in a statement to Capital News Illinois. The repeal removes a federal barrier that was driving energy policy in the wrong direction. At the same time, officials at a local utility union that represents workers from the Powerton Generating Station in Pekin and the Kincaid Generating Station, IBEW Local 15, are hoping the new federal policies prevail. Ben Busser, vice president for the local, said he supports the federal government's attempts to extend generating stations beyond their scheduled retirement dates through executive orders. Since last May, the U.S. Department of Energy has issued a series of emergency orders requiring multiple coal-fired power plants in the Midwestern, Southern, and Western United States and in Puerto Rico to remain operational beyond their planned retirement dates. It seems like the extensions are for 60 to 90 days at a time, but there have been multiple extensions in some cases, Busser said. There has been some hope due to seeing this occur in other states, including Michigan, Indiana, Washington, and Colorado. Maybe it is possible to see that happen in Illinois. Busser said, typically, the jobs offered by coal stations are in rural locations without many other career opportunities. With the closure of the plants, Illinois will lose approximately 140 union jobs. Our members do know of their planned scheduled closure dates, and they are scared about what they will do following their station's closure, he said. The state, however, is also suing the federal administration for moving to maintain coal-fired plants to continue operating beyond their retirement dates. Raoul joined Minnesota's Attorney General Keith Ellison in saying the decision would increase the amount of pollution emitted in the region, harming the public's health and welfare. Without the support from the federal government, Jack Darren, director of the Illinois chapter of the Sierra Club, said state departments like the Illinois EPA and the Illinois Department of Natural Resources will have to step up and do more, provided they have the budget. The Sierra Club also sued the federal EPA over the repeal of those protections. It is what we need to do to not follow the federal government in taking us backwards to dirtier air and blocking clean energy jobs, Darren said. Caldwell said federal policies shifting to favor fossil fuel generation could slow the pace of clean energy deployment and complicate Illinois' transition. Federal rollbacks could create market uncertainty, slow investment, and misrepresent regional power markets, making it harder and more expensive for Illinois to meet its climate and clean energy targets, she said. Illinois has a long history with coal. It was in Illinois where the first recorded coal reserves in North America were discovered in 1673. Until recently, the two coal-fired plants operated in or near Peoria were the E.D. Edwards Power Plant near Bartonville and the Powerton Plant. The pollution generated by them has, throughout time, been linked to adverse health effects in surrounding communities. Martha Ross, a Peoria Public Schools board member and resident of the south side of Peoria, organizes meetings in the city to discuss those issues. Their children struggle with asthma, but they just go to the emergency room, Ross said. Nobody's going to get into the real problem. What's causing those issues? And I do think it has a lot to do with the environment. Federal environmental rules played a role in getting the Edwards plant closed in 2023. Three nonprofit organizations, Natural Resources Defense Council, Respiratory Health Association, and Sierra Club, sued Illinois Power Resources Generating, at the time the owner and operator of the E.D. Edwards plant. The organizations argued the plant violated certain clean air emission standards on thousands of occasions between 2008 and 2014. On September 16, 2019, the nonprofit organizations announced a settlement in the case that included the shuttering of the plant by the end of 2022. The Powerton plant, located in nearby Pekin, remains open, though CEJA provisions put it on a path to close by 2030. According to Vistra, the Kincaid plant's administrator, the plant is slated to close by 2027. Caldwell remains hopeful that Illinois laws and its lawmakers will ensure that happens. CEJA established clear, long-term clean energy targets and timelines. Coal plants face increasing economic pressure from cheaper renewable energy and declining operating margins, she said. Illinois has made a clear policy commitment to transitioning to a cleaner power sector. Gabriel Castillo is a graduate student in journalism with Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, Media, and Integrated Marketing Communications, and is a fellow in its Medill, Illinois News Bureau, working in partnership with Capital News Illinois. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of news outlets statewide. It is funded primarily by the Illinois Press Foundation and the Robert R. McCormick Foundation. Education. Will state ban cell phones in class in 26? By Sam Freeman, Medill, Illinois News Bureau, Springfield. After the Latin School of Chicago passed a cell phone ban, students who typically would be glued to their phones on their way to class looked up, interacted with their peers, and were more immersed in school, officials said. The Latin School of Chicago first restricted cell phone use for the 2024-25 school year, and a year later revised it to a total ban during school hours. Since then, students recognize increased engagement both during instructional time and breaks. I'm grateful for the phone ban. I'll take a more connected community over the minor conveniences of a cell phone any day. Scarlett Gittleson, the editor-in-chief of the student-run paper The Fulcrum, said in an op-ed. As the Illinois legislature once again considers a statewide cell phone ban in schools, it looks to success stories like the Latin School to propose a bill aimed at addressing mental health and enhancing student success. A push to regulate in Illinois. Illinois is one of only 8 states that have no statewide restrictions on the use of cell phones in public schools. an amendment to Senate Bill 2427, which passed the Illinois House Education Committee unanimously on March 25th, would require all Illinois public and charter schools to adopt policies restricting student use of cell phones, tablets, and other devices during class time. The bill still needs approval from the full House, where it's not subject to a Friday deadline for final action, because a previous version already passed the Senate, 55-0 last year. Because it was amended in the House, however, the Senate will need to approve the amended version before it can head to Governor J.B. Pritzker, who's been pushing for the measure for 2 years. There's real harm done, and it's interfering with our ability to give children the most productive educational environment possible. It's time to get cell phones out of the classroom, Pritzker said in his February State of the State speech. The line drew bipartisan applause. Under the bill, elementary and middle schools would be required to implement a bell-to-bell ban, while high schools could allow their students to use their devices during lunch and breaks. The policy for high schools would vary according to school district. Last year, the bill didn't receive a House vote due to concerns about enforcement and exceptions. The revised version includes a list of exceptions, including medical necessity, individualized education programs, and for English learners accessing materials. It also limits disciplinary actions, such as suspension or expulsion, and it prohibits enforcement through fines, fees, or law enforcement action. If the bill is passed and signed by the governor, policies would need to be implemented by the 2027-28 school year. But school districts that already have cell phone restrictions in place have until 2030-31 to ensure their policies conform with state requirements. Prioritizing academic success. Currently, 42 states and Washington, D.C. have laws or policies that either prohibit or limit student cell phone use, or require individual districts to either ban or limit their use. There are a lot of different states that have introduced this bill, and I think it passed with a broad bipartisan support because they recognize the importance of banning these devices, with some exceptions, of course. So that way, students are successful, said Senator Christina Castro, Democrat Elgin. These policies, though varied by state, are aimed at improving focus and reducing bullying. According to the Pew Research Center, approximately 72% of high school teachers say phone distractions are a major problem, compared to 33% of middle school teachers and 6% of elementary school teachers. These distractions are proven to negatively impact student success and mental health. A 2023 survey of adolescents showed that 51% reported using social media for more than 3 hours per day. Social media use by adolescents is associated with higher rates of anxiety and depression, according to the National Library of Medicine. Social media use has become a major issue among adolescents, with thousands of lawsuits alleging that addictive platform designs harm children's mental health. In a landmark court ruling in late March, Meta and YouTube were found liable on all counts of using addictive design features that harmed young users and created mental health problems. Cell phone use is also linked to cyberbullying. According to KFF, 9 in 10 public schools reported instances of cyberbullying in the 2023-24 school year. Cyberbullying can lead to emotional distress, depression, and suicidal ideation. It's also more likely to be experienced by females and LGBT plus adolescents. I think taking as many distractions off the table for students will allow them to focus on their studies as well as their teachers and professors in the classroom, Castro said, so they get their undivided attention and it'll have great student success outcomes. How are bell-to-bell bans implemented? A cell phone ban would require devices to be placed in secure and accessible storage, like backpacks, desk storage, lockers, or pouches. Although the bill does not require districts to purchase additional storage options, some teachers' unions worry about costs for implementation or added responsibility to teachers. Schools already have the authority to set cell phone policies, but what they cannot do is fund themselves or the cell phone lockers or pockets that will be required to enforce this unfunded mandate, the Illinois Federation of Teachers said in a news release. The union represents 105,000 teachers and paraprofessionals throughout Illinois. Peoria's District 150, which already has a policy restricting cell phone use, spent $250,000 on Yonder pouches. Yonder bags lock automatically when the top is snapped together, and they can only be unlocked when tapped against a magnetic base. They typically cost between $20 and $30 per student. To assist with implementing the policy, a number of states with similar legislation offered grants. For example, New York allocated $13.5 million in funding for the implementation of its ban, specifically for lockable pouches. Illinois' bill does not allocate funds for implementation. Only the governor can ultimately meet the state's funding obligation, said Cindy Oberl-Dom, executive vice president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. Chicago airports, worker misconduct probed. Watchdog report alleges drinking on duty, time card fraud. By Talia Soglin, Chicago Tribune, Chicago. On the clock, city employees drank at bars near O'Hare International Airport and then returned to the airport for the remainder of their shifts, an investigation by the city's Office of Inspector General found. The city watchdog investigation details numerous instances of alcohol consumption by airport employees during working hours. In one case, several on-the-clock aviation department employees attended a party thrown by an off-duty colleague where they imbibed beer, cocktails, and shots of liquor before returning to work at the airport. In other instances, aviation department supervisors bought alcohol for their employees while out to lunch, the report said. The OIG's investigation involved a total of 14 subjects, most of whom were or are employed by the city's aviation department, which oversees O'Hare and Midway airports. The watchdog determined that a total of 7 employees made false statements to the OIG over the course of its investigation, the details of which were released Wednesday as part of the OIG's first quarter report. In addition to drinking while they were supposed to be working, the OIG found that current and former aviation department employees took extended breaks without proper authorization, falsified their time records, spent hours at a time idling while on the clock, demonstrated incompetence in their managerial duties, stole city property, and lied to OIG during an official investigation. The OIG recommended the city departments either discipline or discharge and bar from future city employment the subjects of the investigation. According to the report, the departments preliminarily agreed with those recommendations. Spokespeople for the Aviation Department, CDOT, and DWM did not immediately respond to requests for comment on Wednesday. We'll take a break now and return with the second half of the Herald and Review dated Thursday, April 16th, 2026. Please stay tuned.